This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's talk earthquakes with someone who knows quite a bit about them, Harold Tobin, who is the director of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. First, give me your current assessment of the health of our tectonic plates. Have they been jostling a lot? Have they been relatively calm? Where do we stand?
Actually, in our region, we're in something we're sort of informally calling the earthquake drought, meaning really? There haven't been so many earthquakes over the past decade or two.
Is that good news or bad news?
Well, I think it's completely neutral. We have no reason to believe that it's any particular news at all.
Because I'm trying to think, every 6 months the paper puts in an article about how terrible things are going to be when the big earthquake hits, and, you know, reminds me to put more bags of rice in my emergency food kit. Mm-hmm. But I need to know which side to root for. Do I root for a lot of little tremors, hoping that that's a slow release of the pressure, or do I root for, like, zero tremors, hoping that that means the tectonic plates have finally stabilized for good?
Yeah, it's a fiendish thing because turns out the little tremors really don't relieve any significant amount of the pressure. You might have heard us say that it's a log scale. So a magnitude 8 is 30 times bigger than a magnitude 7. The 9, the big one, is 30 times bigger than that 8. That's it takes 1,000 sevens to relieve the pressure of 1.9. So that's the problem. They're doing what they always do. They're moving around slowly, and the earthquakes are the result.
In short, there are no clues that would allow you to tell us when the next big one comes.
We don't have any sort of short-term meaning weeks to months to years, precursors that we're seeing or something like that.
The good news here is that even though we can't predict earthquakes, we can certainly create an alert system to give us at least a little warning that one is on the way. And there was recently a test in California of just such a system. We are working on one for this area, too, aren't we?
That's correct, yeah. Well, there's a system called Shake Alert. And Shake Alert, actually, the good news is the system itself to detect big earthquakes and be able to, within seconds, issue an alert that one has started and which areas it's going to affect is already in place. It's not complete for our region. There are gaps in our coverage. But as of this past fall, a few months ago, we have a live Shake Alert system. The next big piece, the sort of phase two for us, is integrating that alert into society, allowing us to issue a public alert over cell phone system or the emergency alerting system. And what we have right now are a number of pilot programs that are either testing or in some cases actually implementing those already.
It detects when the shaking starts and then instantly sends out a message that buzzes your cell phone, similar to an Amber Alert. And since the electrical signal travels much faster than the actual earthquake wave through the ground, you can get, but it's only a matter of, what, seconds or minutes, best case?
Yeah, it's seconds up to a couple of minutes, depending on what it is. So, you know, you think of an earthquake, it happens on a fault somewhere under the ground. That's right. The actual cause of the quake is the slip or rupture of that fault. So if you think of that as like dropping a pebble in a pond while the ripples spread over the pond surface, the earthquake damage that we get from the shaking is actually the ripples. So if a massive, you know, if the big one happens offshore in the Cascadia megathrust, we call it, that will actually give us somewhere between, depending on where it begins offshore, 30 seconds to a minute and a half or so of warning, even actually up to 2 minutes of warning. It doesn't sound like much, right? But you can actually...
It's enough to run the hell out of the building.
It's enough to do a lot of things. I want to stop you right there because our
well,
best advice, if you're in
don't
a building, is
right.
Drop cover and hold on, right?
See, that was my reflex.
Actually, the thing that happens, and this is really well documented around the world, is most people who are killed or injured are because they're in motion, moving through the building or trying to get out of the building. The exterior facade falls on them, something like that. So,
stay in place
is the advice we have, Now, that the only thing that the distinction for that is if you're on the coast and you feel a strong earthquake, assume there's a tsunami coming. In that case, you have anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes probably of evacuation time. We want people to get out of there.
Are you satisfied that we have adequately retrofitted old buildings and designed new buildings to be usable in the event of a big earthquake? And I say usable because I understand that the standards or the thinking on this has changed somewhat. That under the current standard, people would survive the earthquake, but the building would be a total loss, which is almost as bad as not surviving because now you have, you know, 800,000 people with no sewer, no water, no electricity. Is it feasible to design buildings to a higher standard such that they could continue not just to stand, but to actually function after a big earthquake?
Yeah, you've got the current status right, exactly. Our buildings tend to be our large buildings, especially the big downtown business buildings and things, tend to be designed to that survivability, but not usability after the earthquake standard. In Japan, it's not like that. Large buildings are built to a standard that they will just continue to function more or less normally soon after the earthquake. So it is feasible to do it. It's certainly a little bit more expensive, but on the other hand, the post-earthquake aftermath would be far more expensive than that. We also know, I should say, that we have lots of non-retrofitted older buildings, especially the ones we call unreinforced masonry, basically old brick buildings, brick and stone buildings, that we know are likely to collapse or be severely damaged.
There's no requirement for those to be all retrofitted?
There's no requirement for them all to be retrofitted, you know, except in the case where they're undergoing renovations or enhancements. But we still have non-retrofitted schools, public buildings, as well as privately owned buildings.
The other question comes up is, I never hear this discussed, how does the average wood frame suburban house do in a big earthquake?
Well, maybe that's a little bit of a bright spot, because in general, yeah, single-family dwellings are better places to be in an earthquake than a taller building. They shake less. There's certainly lots of them that might move off their foundation, have significant damage, but be less likely to actually cause casualties, you know, kill people.
And I also wonder about giant trees. I'm noticing that a lot of the suburban neighborhoods have been there for a while. It looks like an old-growth forest. I mean, you have some. I have an immense Douglas fir in the backyard. Do trees withstand earthquakes, or can the shaking be enough that they just give up and tip over?
Trees are remarkably resilient because they're bendy and they have good root systems, right? I was actually a much younger person in 1989 in the Loma Prieta earthquake, the World Series earthquake, and I was standing in a redwood forest at the time the earthquake started.
Really?
Trees were shaking like crazy. A lot of them snapped their tops off, so it looked like a rain of Christmas trees around me. I didn't feel endangered by it, but
really?
I saw them falling out of the trees. But trees themselves go fine.
So talking about the shake alert system, what's the status of it here in Washington State in terms of paying for it?
Yeah, well, we have federal funding coming in so that we're building out our network of stations. But the governor's budget release earlier this year included $5 million to finish the construction of the stations in Washington. This is great effort because in both California and Oregon, they've put millions of dollars of state money behind it. What I understand right now is that the House legislature bill has $0 in it for this earthquake early warning system. But the Senate's bill has the $5 million in it. So it's the process of the next couple of months of the legislature deciding whether they're going to fund that. And we really hope that they will.
Harold Tobin is the director of the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. Harold, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me today.
623. It was pretty interesting, Chris, to talk with him about the building standards, because what they're finding is that some of the new high rises in this town, anyway, are apparently don't have to be built to the higher standard. So in an earthquake, they would become basically high-rise encampments, because you wouldn't have water, you wouldn't have electricity, you wouldn't have sewer.
Oh, wow.
And I was a little surprised by that. But just something to keep in mind before you rent an apartment on the 20th floor.
Yeah, check
you'll,
the
you'll have to.
Specs.
You might have to walk up the stairs for a while if there was a big earthquake. The investigation into last month's crash of a 737 MAX continues. We have some preliminary details out of Ethiopia this morning. Let's go to CBS News travel editor Peter Greenberg. What's this latest information, Peter, that came out yesterday?
Well, the latest information is that the pilots of the plane did have a control problem. They attempted to go through the Boeing manual on how to disengage the flight management system, which they attempted to do by turning off the electrical input to that system. It still didn't change the attitude of the plane. The nose was still in a downward position. They then tried to re-engage the system by putting electricity back in. Still couldn't control the plane, and at this point, the nose is still pointing down. The plane is accelerated in speed, and we know the rest of the story.
Right. Now, everybody is wondering why they turned the system back on. Some of the speculation I read on one of these pilot bulletin boards was that the only reason the pilot would have turned it back on is if the stick was somehow unresponsive. Does that make sense?
It does, because this is a system that was, in its best-case scenario, is designed to override the pilot if the plane is considered going into a stall and automatically put the nose in a downward position. But the problem with any of these systems is when the pilots can't override the system, no matter which manufacturer it is or which airplane it is, that's not a good thing. And the pilots apparently did everything they could based on what the manual told them to do. Remember, this incident happened after the Lion Air crash in Indonesia, so the pilots have been presumably alerted that there was a problem with the system potentially, and this is how you could overcome it. Mm-hmm. Whatever they did apparently did not do that.
There are some veteran pilots who talked about what's called a roller coaster approach to getting out of something like this, because the problem appears to be if the plane is going too fast at low altitude, the forces on that piece of metal, the horizontal stabilizer there, is it's intense, and it sort of jams against the jack screw, so no matter what you do, you can't turn that thing. Now, are pilots trained in these more elaborate recovery procedures these days or not?
In the simulators, they are. They can throw anything at them they can, and they do. I've actually trained. I'm not a pilot, but I've been trained in those simulators, and believe it or not, any conceivable contingency can be thrown at you. We don't know if these pilots had simulator training on this system. I think there's a pretty good chance they did not, because when this system was developed and installed on the planes, it wasn't made part of the simulator training. The simulators weren't even in effect at that point. So, no, I don't think these guys were prepared to do that. Here's the other issue. At the end of a situation like this, the only thing the pilots had at their disposal was power. With throttle.
Yeah.
And in a last-ditch effort, you know, a lot of pilots in previous accidents attempted to power out of it. In this case, that may have also meant they hit the ground even faster.
We have seen some subpoenas now of Boeing designers. Are they going to challenge the entire design of the plane? And what does this tell you about the direction the investigation is headed?
I don't think they're going to challenge the entire design of the plane, although that will come into play. What they're challenging is the entire certification process. What did Boeing know? When did they know it? And who is the person who certified the plane if not a Boeing-designated or an FAA-designated inspector who happens to work for Boeing? This is a system that's been in place for dozens and dozens of years where the FAA, which does not have the resources, the manpower, or the budget, allows that relationship to happen. It wasn't just at Boeing. They did it at McDonnell Douglas and at Lockheed. It's now coming to play now. And it's being questioned by Congress as well as the other investigations.
Now, is it significant to you that these two crashes did not involve American airline companies?
Well, you could claim, although there's no basis in fact for this, that the pilots of the other airlines didn't get the memo, or they weren't properly trained. I think that's a pretty bad rush to judgment here.
Yeah,
I'm just not sure all the pilots of all the airlines weren't properly trained. You know, when you're only seeing pilots given training on the 737 MAX with a 56-minute program on an iPad, that in itself raises some questions. And that has not to do with an American airline. That has to do with all airlines.
Okay. And the other thing is that this is just my impression based on a clip of video I saw of the wreckage area. There were people sort of poking around. There was a backhoe there. Is the evidence being properly collected at those sites?
The NTSB will tell you that evidence collection is crucial in a situation like this. The forensic work needs to be done on so many different levels. As you may know, anytime there's an accident, the NTSB sends a go team that's divided among metallurgy, engineering, weather, human factors. It goes on and on and on. And crisis response time is crucial as well. So the very first video we saw of a backhoe didn't give me a warm and fuzzy feeling about proper evidence collection.
Yeah, that was my feeling exactly. CBS travel editor Peter Greenberg. Peter, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Here it is, just 2 years after the McCleary fix, and state lawmakers are again wrangling over school levies, and Microsoft and Amazon appear to be on opposite sides of a proposal for a big increase in the B&O tax that would hit both companies especially hard, money to be raised in the name of education. Let's go to Kyra's Hannah Scott to sort this out. So let's first start with the McCleary fix. The idea of that was that since education is the paramount duty of the state.
Yep. Basic education.
Basic education, that all school districts should be level, right?
Yep.
Everybody should have that. And so we're not going to let the rich districts raise a lot more money than the poor districts, correct?
That was the idea. So that all happened back in 2017. The state legislature increased the statewide property tax to level everything out, spread all that money amount around to the 295 school districts, at the same time capping the amount of local levies that those local districts could could ask for from their local voters. The idea then was, of course, that the money from the state would offset whatever losses districts face because of the levy cap. The swap, though, left many of the larger property-rich districts coming up short, with millions of projected in shortfalls and planned layoffs now on the horizon. Now both the House and the Senate are considering bills to tweak the levy cap or lift it. At a recent hearing on the House version, Dave Mastin with the Office of the Superintendent of Public Education described what he says. When it comes to basic education, there are two different definitions, and that's part of the problem.
And the definition at the legislative level is that we need to fund one nurse for 6,500 students. One nurse for 6,500 students. We need to fund one social worker for 18,000 students. And so you can see, while basic education in the legislative constitutional framework is one thing, it means something different to the school districts, where clearly we need more social workers and more nurses than that. And I could go on with several different examples, but that's why we're here asking you to look at levies again.
So essentially, what looked good on paper for the legislature maybe doesn't work out in real life for
they
the districts.
They seriously thought, what was it, one social worker for 18,000
right.
students?
Yeah, and like one nurse for 6,500 students. And obviously that doesn't work. So they need more money. That's the deal. But what about those property-poor districts? Travis Hansen is with the Deer Park School District just outside of Spokane.
Unfortunately, proposed legislation significantly reduces enhancement monies available to Deer Park. While the levy swap introduced in 2242 reduced the per-student funding gap that existed between property-rich and property-poor school districts around the state, it did so at the expense of what many districts statewide have provided to their communities. It's clear that good levy policy that's good for a community like Deer Park is not necessarily good for districts like Seattle, Tacoma, Spokane, and Meade.
All of those districts, by the way, are saying they're going to have to cut staff and have big budget shortfalls, if including other districts, Everett, most
now,
of the large school districts.
Are these the rich districts complaining then?
The rich districts are, yeah, absolutely.
Because the poor districts should be fat and happy, shouldn't they? Because they're getting more than before.
That person that was just speaking is from one of the poor districts.
I
and
see.
He's saying, look, it's not. There's no one way. It can't just be this blanket proposal that works, because what works for the big districts does not work for us. So what he did, he spoke at a recent House hearing on the House version, and he urged lawmakers to try to come up with some way to protect those property poor districts, but also still help those larger districts that are currently facing shortfalls. That hasn't happened yet. But basically, right now, both bills are moving. They've got about 3 weeks to try to hammer out some sort of compromise. There are varying different proposals in the two bills that are pretty complex.
Well, I'm really confused, because I thought what he's complaining about is exactly what we just spent 2 years fixing.
And it is. He's trying to urge the lawmakers to find a better fix that will work for both the poor districts and the richer districts, property richer districts. I don't know that that can happen. It's a big ask.
We need more money for everybody.
Yeah, and there's again, it's a super complicated, complex process, a very budget-related. There are a couple of possibilities.
You'd have to do it like baseball. Like, the rich baseball teams are sort of taxed. I think they still have a luxury tax, right, Chris? Where if you're like the Yankees, you pay a luxury tax, so the poorer teams get more money.
And they also share in the revenue with the TV contracts as well.
Well, there's no TV contracts for the schools, unfortunately. But
that would be fun to watch.
But so, in other words, like Lake Washington, if it wants to pass a Cadillac program, would be taxed a portion of that to go to Deer Park.
I mean, you could, as part of a conversation. I want to point out, again, the levies are only supposed to go for those beyond basic education services. So these are discussions that are going to play out over the next few weeks. The big concern here, though, is from Republicans like Senator John Braun.
Majorities in both chambers are proposing now that we double our local levy authority. And that's very troubling for me. It sets the stage for us to go down the path of not fully funding education at the state level. I think it's a very dangerous bill that sets us up for failure in the future, and probably the thing I'm most worried about during this session.
So that what he's saying there is, look, we could fall out of compliance with the Supreme Court, right? So they have to be very careful about this. My sense is that both of these bills have moved because they had to meet various deadlines, but there's a lot more work to be done. So we'll keep you posted.
Okay. Let's see. We're going to talk about these tax increases that are going to be imposed on Microsoft and Amazon.
So this is a proposal just dropped last week. It was, and actually, first, Brad Smith from Microsoft, the president of Microsoft, had written an op-ed in the Seattle Times about a week prior to the bill hitting. What this is a tax on the education front. It would increase the B&O tax at various levels for something called the workforce education. Essentially what this is I think it's about $1 billion over the next 4 years to increased financial aid for students who are looking for degrees in engineering, hospital type work. There's dozens of different fields, and it's varying degrees. So it starts at 20% increase to the B&O tax, up to 33%. It depends on your revenue, but the big part here is that it's 67% increase in the B&O tax for those companies with revenue, gross revenue of more than $100 billion. That only applies to Microsoft and to Amazon. So again, Brad Smith from Microsoft, he basically asked for this.
Sounds like a wealth tax.
he's saying, look, we in this high tech sector, we should pay more to get to help all of those students get the talent that we need down the line. I reached out to Amazon last night to see what they thought about this bill. Basically, they said they have a long history of supporting local education through levies, gifts, higher education, but they felt that this would be more fair if it was spread out among more businesses, not just hitting those two top businesses. One of the other things, though, I want to point out about this bill in the hearing is that it does impact many of those other businesses that we're talking about, hospitals, small businesses that are going to be hit. And some of them said possibly lead to layoffs and various other things. I'll show you a mix of some of what they're talking about.
I would encourage the state to move forward and to continue to invest in higher education.
This bill will affect over 95,000 businesses in the state. Most of those, well over 90%, are small businesses.
The surcharge will easily turn projects into losses for many firms. The resulting effect is that firms will be forced to reduce operating costs.
From a Student Achievement Council standpoint, a very critical one to help all students have access to a fantastic pathway to a career in college.
Now, the concern.
That was a mix of some of the testimony.
Said
it only applied to business like Microsoft and Amazon, but I thought it also ended up applying to newspapers.
The 67% mark would increase, would apply only to. So that giant increase would go just for Microsoft.
But there would still be
Amazon.
Increases for other businesses, too.
Dozens, engineering, hospitals. We heard from some folks in the newspaper industry that said that this would hurt them even further than they already are hurt, lead to more cutbacks that they can't afford. Hospitals spoke out a lot against this, so we'll see how it goes. Could come up for a committee vote today.
All right, very good. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Mother's Day, about a month away. Already a 13-year-old has put most of us to shame. Just try and top this. William Rabilo is his name. His mom, Crystal Preston, she's a single mom. And times are tough.
He was tired of seeing me cry.
She didn't know, though, that her son was doing the usual 13-year-old jobs, mowing lawns, cleaning yards, and saving that money for her. More specifically, a car for her. Once he felt he had enough, he took to Facebook, found a posting for a cheap car, then leveraged his pile of cash plus his prized Xbox.
It was really cheap, so I asked if I could trade the Xbox or earn it. And then she said, at first she said no, and then she said she thought about it, and then she said yes.
Then he surprised his mom. This 13-year-old bought his mom a car.
Mom, I got you a car, and then she's like, no, you didn't. And then I was like, I did, and then she didn't believe me.
And so he showed her, speechless, in tears. She finally had to believe him when she saw the car for herself.
At my, low point, here comes my son. You know, everybody goes through rough patches in their life, but, there's good that can come from any situation, as long as somebody with a heart does it.
There you go. You got a month to think about Mother's Day.
That's right. Sports Insider is sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, the man who believes every umpire should be heckled, whether he deserves it or not, Danny O'Neill. Although this guy, I think, really does deserve it. I saw some of the video. This is umpire Ron Culpa, who was...
Mea Culpa.
Yeah. Who was umpiring, Texas Astros and the Rangers?
Battle of Houston. Battle of Texas.
Yeah, so pretty big game. And you look at the box that they now superimpose, and someone where the ball goes into the dirt, and he says, strike! And he keeps doing that.
Yes.
And he was doing it on purpose, apparently.
Well, I don't know about that. He made a call, and it was a pitch that the entire Astros bench thought was low. And everybody in the bench, in the dugout, reacted to it. And you saw people come up onto the rail and holler at him. Mm-hmm. Umpires do not like that.
No, they don't.
They don't like the biggest thing you're not supposed to do to an umpire is show him up. You can say anything you want, but don't. Once you start gesturing, once you start making a big to-do about it, once you start coming up to the lip of the dugout to say, come on, punch a hole in your mask, things like that, they tend to get mad.
Is that the best you can come up with?
Well, yes, for this radio show. Yeah. Use your good eye.
How
do you fit such a square head in your round mask?
There we go. Now we're talking.
And the umpire and the manager, A.J. Hinch, sensed what was about to happen because the umpire was then yelling at their bench of like, get back. I don't want to hear any more of it. The manager goes out to talk to him. And then the umpire remained very, very mad. And when he put his mask on, that's my favorite part. He's like, I'm so mad. I'm going to put my mask on hard, pull it down hard over my eyes because I'm angry. I'm so angry. And then he really didn't like something one of the hitting coaches said, and then it was on. And apparently afterward, after he ejected A.J. Hinch, the Astros manager shouted to him, it appears from my amateur lip reading, said, I can do anything I want.
Wow.
The umpire did?
Yeah, the umpire said that to him.
Wow. That's dangerous,
well,
I think.
Yes.
Is it just somebody's pride getting in the way of them doing their job?
It's pride?
He should be suspended.
I would agree. Now, we do have different expectations because we tolerate a manager taking things personally, mm-hmm. right? We allow that.
Well, but they can't change the course of the game by getting mad.
Right. And that's how I feel about officials. It happens in the NBA even more than it does in baseball.
Oh.
Football generally tends to be the least personal when it comes to it. There are officials that have grudges against players. Good officials that have Joey Crawford, who was for a long time one of the better NBA officials, had a problem with Tim Duncan to the point where he ejected Tim Duncan once because Duncan laughed while on the bench. Like laughed, just gestured, didn't curse at him, didn't do any, like he was out of the game and he laughed and kind of clapped his hands and Joey Crawford looked over at him and ejected him. And those things happened. Greg Popovich, the Spurs coach, he's been ejected twice in the past week. The first one he deserved. The first one he was raging furious at a young official, and you could tell the young official was intimidated, and Popovich took every advantage of it, was stalking him around the court. Yeah. Like, he earned every ounce of that ejection. He got kicked out 63 seconds into a game last night.
Yeah, I saw that.
He got kicked out 63 seconds. He did not earn that ejection.
So, when there is official overreach like that, is there a council of referees that convenes to...
They've got a union, but the union tends to protect the idiots. Because that's the other thing, is there are bad officials, there are bad umpires. There are two god-awful umpires. Two people who... They should go work at a sandwich shop. They're terrible, terrible umpires. Angel Hernandez and C.B. Buckner have no business calling Major League Baseball games. They're bad.
I'm glad you didn't just say my friend. I have one person I know who's an MLB umpire.
They're legitimately bad.
It makes me wonder, though, is there a type of umpire? Or, you know, it's sort of like you can pigeonhole some people like you're this type of job. Is there a certain type? Do they like the control? Do they like the power of the... Or is it just a wide array of people that take on this position?
If they do, we should weed those people out. Mm. We should try and what we'll call that is the mall cop persona.
Okay.
I
was going to talk about security.
We should not have the mall cop persona.
And that's what I'm wondering, because you see this behavior. It's not uncommon.
No. And there is a certain element of they officiate enough games. NBA officials officiate enough games with these guys that it can be useful to have a personal relationship, to be able to tell someone, hey, I'm tired of hearing it. Sit down.
Uh-huh.
And to be able to have that kind of rapport. But when it becomes a grudge, I think we'd all agree, the moment it gets to a grudge, you've got a serious issue because now you're questioning and you're compromising the objectivity of somebody who's expected to do that.
Yeah.
In the end, umpires should be like furniture. Referees should be like furniture. They should just take whatever they're given.
Okay, now I have to deliver on a promise I made yesterday that you're going to give us a number for keeping Russell Wilson.
Oh.
$35.8 million, average over a four-year extension.
Per year?
Yep.
Per
average.
Year.
Yep, 35.8. That'll get it done.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
He's got futures and agent.
A-O.
Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. We're to get to the latest on distracted driving habits and some of the stranger ones in a moment. Before that, Chris has another commute problem to fix for a member of the staff here.
Yes. After helping you out on your tunnel issues, I decided to help Dory out a little bit. He had been convinced that something was happening with the signal timing at the end of the I-5 southbound ramp to Roanoke. So just here above the station, something that he's driven to for years. And I have been seeing it back up significantly for the last month and a half or so. I wasn't sure if it was related to maybe some new tunnel traffic pattern. Maybe people decided to use I-5 instead of trying to take the 99 corridor. So I'm still trying to figure out exactly. But there was something going on there at that off-ramp. And Dory said, please, check this thing out.
I have never seen a backup onto I-5. When I come into work, whether it be 9:30, 10:30, and I said, something has changed.
So I went to the Department of Transportation, which manages the signal at the end of the off-ramp to check it out. And SDOT engineers went there, checked it out, and they said, no, there's nothing wrong with the signal timing. We haven't changed anything. Nothing is out of the ordinary. And then when I went there on Sunday, just Sunday. It was backed up about 13 cars deep trying to get off at Roanoke. I was like, okay, SDOT, can you guys please take another look at that and see if, I mean, did you miss something? And it turns out the engineers did miss something when they checked it out the first time. There was actually a problem with the camera that monitors how many cars are lined up at the signal. It wasn't counting them properly, and it wasn't then helping trip the signal. And that was causing some of these backups. So the city's working on a fix, and I think they actually have fixed it because I didn't see as much of a backup early this morning as I saw. And Dory had a much better drive-in yesterday. So, yeah, so it looks good. Like SDOT willing to look at things, and they fixed it, and that's good news.
Well, that's a pretty short ramp, so you're not going to handle that much.
No, it can't. No, here. Not at all.
All right, there is another project in Tacoma running behind schedule involving the Puyallup River, but this is not the I-5 bridge.
This
is a different bridge.
This is different. This is, I believe it probably would be the original Puyallup River Bridge through the Tacoma area connecting Tacoma and Fife. It's 92 years old, and in May, they shut it down. So I featured it as a choke point last year because it's just so old. It's been load restricted for at least a decade because they're worried about its stability. And my Cairo radio listener, Shannon, she's like, what's the deal? This was supposed to be wrapped up at the beginning of the year. Now I've heard it's supposed to be the spring. Can you get an update? And I checked with the city of Tacoma, and not only is it not going to be done until the spring, it's not going to be done until the middle of July. It's going to be about 6-7 months behind schedule. And so I went to the city and said, hey, what's going on down there? What can you tell me about? And they said, well, first of all, the weather's been terrible, as you know, I mean, through all the snow and everything. So that pushed us behind a little bit. But then they also found some more damage to the bridge that they had in their initial inspections. And they decided, okay, well, we've got this thing shut down. Let's take care of that as well. So that's pushed the window back a little bit. And then they're also working over the active BNSF freight tracks, and we've talked about projects all over the region being stopped by that because you only get so much time between the trains to run there and go and start working above them. So they've dealt with a variety of issues, and that's why that Puyallup River Bridge there north of I-5 connecting downtown Tacoma and Fife is behind schedule. Look for that to clear up in June or July, excuse me.
Okay, you also spoke with the National Safety Council about distracted driving. They've issued a new survey. And apparently, once again, smartphones are screwing things up.
Yeah, I talked to the vice president of the council, Kelly Nantel, early this morning. This is Distracted Driving Month, in case you haven't noticed. So there's an emphasis going on. And so they did a study that was focused on how driver behavior is around first responders. So you see an accident on the side of the road, or there's a state trooper has somebody pulled over. You see flashing lights. And you know that I've been clamoring for years about how we slow down needlessly for that stuff to look at these accidents and how that causes unnecessary congestion. Well, according to Nantel, today's drivers are taking it up a notch.
71% of the individuals we surveyed admitted to taking photos or videos when they see an emergency vehicle stopped on the side of the road.
Yes, they're taking video. And then 60% of those drivers who are taking video or pictures admit to posting those pictures or videos online while they're still driving.
1 in 10 of the folks that we surveyed said that as a result of their distraction, they either struck or nearly struck one of the responder vehicles that they saw stopped on the side of the road.
And I mean, how many times have we talked about that? A state trooper someone in a work zone? I mean, not paying attention. I mean, this is a significant issue. Now, the National Safety Council supports legislation that would increase penalties and certainly enforcement for distracted driving.
Americans are just unwilling to put their phones down when they are behind the wheel, and that's really problematic.
Okay, so what's the solution? Obviously, we could fine the heck out of people. I mean, we upped our distracted driving penalty, but it's really hard to enforce through our downtown core. what Nantel says that drivers really need to think about the unintended consequences of what could happen before they reach for their phone.
In my perfect world, yes, the phone would be out of the car. We survived for many decades without phones in our car. I think we can do it again, quite easily. It's just a matter of discipline and taking the phone out of your reach.
So try a drive with a phone in the glove box, maybe in the back seat, or even in the trunk. I'm going to try that on the way home today.
You're going to put it in the trunk?
See if that, yeah, a lot of kids put theirs in their trunk, too, yeah, to make sure that they do it, or parents ask them to put it so there's no way you can get to it. So I'm going to give that a try, because, I mean, I use my phone, I admit, while I'm driving, primarily to keep an eye on the GPS or things like that. I'm a good for a one-touch, but or maybe more. So, yeah, I mean, I know we all do it, but something, I'm not sure how you get at it, you know, to find a way to really get us be, because even today, I mean, you can't go 5 seconds without seeing someone talking into their hand or do, I mean.
The laws have not worked at all.
No.
So maybe you have to, I mean, we've learned that when you buy a liquor or something, right, you don't have it in the seat next to you. You put it in the trunk, right?
Right.
I don't think it's even legal to have it in the seat next to you.
No,
it?
I don't believe it. I mean, not only open container, I mean, certainly, but yeah. I mean, just the stuff there that you bought at the store, no.
Yeah, so I mean, if we accept that, maybe that's what it has to come down to. If somebody sees you with the car, and that means you can't use it for GPS, that means you'll have to migrate to some system that where it displays it on the built-in screen in your car or something. But if that's what it takes, maybe that, I mean, because the statistics are pretty decisive on this, right?
Oh,
That this is an epidemic and it's causing accidents and it's killing people.
Yeah, and you talk about the inboard display, too. I have a major problem with that from a policy standpoint as well. And I asked the Safety Council about that. I find those, my in-dash display, to be even more distracting than my phone ever was. As I told you, you could hold the phone up in front of your eye and at least have vision of the road. To look at my damn inbox, I physically have to turn my head, especially with these new glasses that I'm wearing, and I find that more distracting. And they're like, yeah, that is, they have an issue with those as well. I mean, then what does that mean? Everything has to be a heads-up display on your, but that could be just as distracting. Nice. I mean, I guess we just got to realize when you're in the car to drive, you're in the car to drive. And I guess we have to leave it at that.
Well, she pointed out that we got along for years without the smartphones, but she's talking to a much older generation. Pretty soon, most people will never know a time when there wasn't a smartphone.
Correct.
And they will not know how to get along without the smartphone.
Yeah.
Unless you do something draconian.
Yeah. And at that point, yeah, what do we have? EMP inside
your car?
They'll
drive themselves. They'll drive themselves by
that. Yeah, flying cars and drive. By that time, light rail will be completely mature, and we won't need to drive our cars anymore.
That's it. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I'll bet you've read the story about Joe Cameron, the woman who feels no pain. Heather Murphy wrote about this for the New York Times. And Heather, the one question I want to start off with was, when you say she feels no pain, does that mean she has no feeling at all, or just no feeling for pain?
No feeling for pain. I mean, I think it's so hard for most of us to even begin to fathom what that must be like. But I think one of the interesting ways she helped me sort of understand it is when she was talking about giving birth. She has two children and she's given birth twice. And I asked her about it. And it's not that she didn't feel anything. It's not that she couldn't feel that there were changes going on in her body. She could, but she described it as a tickle. And so it's not that she has no senses and doesn't feel that there's things going on. It just doesn't hurt.
So how closely has she been studied? For example, has anybody found out whether the neurons are actually firing but the brain doesn't register, or that the neurons aren't even firing to begin with?
So understanding even just how pain works in general is pretty complex, and it's something that researchers have come a long way in understanding over the past decade. We still have a lot to understand. The focus essentially for the researchers here was what might be at the root of this, and what they did figure out is that there's this genetic mutation that they're calling FAW-OUT is causing essentially the cannabinoid receptors in the body that deal with stressful situations to, she has an elevated number of cannabinoid receptors.
Uh-huh.
And so those, for example, may also be why she doesn't have much anxiety. So that's one piece of it. That's one piece of what that mutation does, is it can increase the cannabinoid receptors to make it easier for her to her to how she processes things, but sort of like the nitty gritty of what's going on is still something they're trying to understand.
Well, I think we know that a large component of pain has to be psychological, because I think there have been placebo experiments to that effect. We're all in those situations where we kind of surprise ourselves for our threshold of pain. But I'm gathering that this is something much more fundamental than that. I mean, these are actual genes that are signaling that this feeling is not something that is to be registered as, quote, pain.
Her case has definitely raised really interesting questions about the line between thinking we feel pain or psychological pain, such as anxiety, and what we think of as physical pain. That is very interesting. But pain is real. I mean, I guess real is a weird word in science, but there is actual physical pain that most people's bodies would just experience. And so for her, even also in those very concrete cases, there's something going on with her body.
Given how deep this goes, if we were going to use her as the basis for some kind of painkiller, it sounds almost dangerous to me because it might be the kind of painkiller that goes too far.
I mean, any kind of painkiller takes decades and millions of dollars and a very long time and lots of layers of testing and development to emerge. So we're not going to see the Joe Cameron painkiller on the market tomorrow, no matter what. But what I have heard talking to people in this realm is that we are really learning something about pain by looking at how people who have different kinds of genetic mutations, she's one of them, experience pain differently than the rest of us. And the possibility that they could create some sort of gene therapy or some sort of alternate method for managing pain built on this does seem promising to a lot of people. But I don't think the end goal is like that thereby we'll all feel like Joe Cameron going through life. That probably won't happen.
Well, it was a great story, well told, and so she was easy to talk to. She was happy to share this, even though it might make her bring a little bit more attention to her than she might like.
She has no anxiety, fortunately.
That's right.
I mean, honestly, this would make anyone very anxious. She's gotten so much attention, and she was so funny. You know, she said, I didn't think anyone would find this interesting, she kept saying to me. It's just her life. When it's just you're in it and it's your everyday life, it's hard, I think, to imagine that it's so different for the rest of us.
Heather Murphy, who wrote the New York Times article about Joe Cameron, the woman who has never felt pain. Heather, thank you very much.
Sure, my pleasure. Nice to speak with you.
She's talking about how this woman has enhanced cannabinoid receptors, so it's almost like she's constantly on pot without having to smoke it.